Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Solar power has traditionally been dismissed as an ethical luxury only available to the wealthy. But since 2008, the price of solar has dropped a whopping 70%. The materials in solar panels are now more efficient and cheaper to manufacture. And then there are government incentives. The California Solar Initiative provides rebates for customers of Pacific Gas and Electric and other electric companies. About 391 megawatts of solar panels were fitted at customer sites across the state last year. That's about 189,000 projects. The price to install residential projects has declined 15% in the past year alone. So with more and more people able to afford solar, how close are we to a transmission to renewable energy? How are the utility companies responding? And what services exist now to help people who would benefit from saving money on electricity bills? Today, we're joined by Tim Sears. He's co-founder and CFO and COO of Grid Alternatives, a nonprofit solar installation company that focuses on helping low-income families get solar. And Tim joins me here in studio. Hi, Tim. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
We're also joined by Chris Nelder, an energy analyst and consultant who has written about energy for more than a decade. He's author of Profit from the Peak and Investing in Renewable Energy. Later today, Chris will be speaking at the Verge Conference in San Francisco, which focuses on technology advancements in energy, buildings, and transportation. And Chris is also in studio. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
Thanks
for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start off talking about the price, because I don't think that a lot of people realize that the price of solar has dropped 70% since 2008. Tim, how has it dropped so much?
There's a variety of reasons. Solar panels, which have traditionally been the biggest cost of solar. When we started Grid Alternatives back in 2004, we were paying over $4 a watt. For those, and now they're available at well under a dollar a watt. So that's a combination of other companies entering the marketplace. A lot of the major solar solar manufacturers are Chinese companies now, as well as an increase in the capacity of silicon refineries worldwide.
And what would you add to that, Chris? Why is the price plummeted 70% since 2008?
Well, a big part of it is the fact that Germany has had a very aggressive feed-in tariff program, which has caused just an enormous boom in demand in Germany. That stimulated a global response in terms of supply, particularly in China. And so, you know, eventually they were able to just capture efficiencies of scale and drive the cost down just in the pure hardware side of things. Germany also managed to really radically reduce the soft costs, that is, the installation costs, the costs of marketing, development, and so on. So all in all, it just created this enormous response in terms of supply and in terms of reducing the costs of getting things installed.
And is any of this manufacturing done in the United States?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there are definitely solar module and inverter manufacturers, racking manufacturers in the United States, absolutely.
There's over 119,000 workers in the solar industry throughout the country, and I think somewhere around a quarter of that are in the manufacturing sector.
So what changes have you seen in terms of rooftop solar installations as the price has dropped?
The price has dropped, it's created more and more of a market. So it's really a feedback loop where companies are able to invest and grow, and that brings the price down further. So it's really enabled the mainstream market to be able to serve a broader segment of the population. And at Grid Alternatives, we're exclusively serve low-income families, and so it's enabled us to help dramatically more families with the same amount of resources.
And is this families that own their own home, or does this also apply to renters?
We currently serve homeowners. There are programs out there in California, a program called the MASH program, multifamily affordable solar housing, that serves renters. And there was just a bill passed that will open up what's called community solar or shared solar, and allow renters to be able to choose to get solar by signing up through their utilities.
What is the average price for the people that you work with?
Well, we're a nonprofit. We work exclusively with low-income families, and we're often able to make the systems no direct financial cost to the homeowners. They contribute in other ways, and we do that by raising funds and accessing different rebate programs that are available specifically for low-income homeowners.
How many families have you worked with?
We are over 3,700 now throughout California and in Colorado and most recently in New York and New Jersey. So it's a little bit over 11 megawatts of solar.
Chris, can you just paint us a big picture here? Just, I mean, is solar really taking off? Is it making a dent when we look at renewables?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, it's often been remarked that as a new technology, or especially an energy technology, comes online, it follows a growth curve kind of in the shape of an S, where you have this slow growth that kind of creeps up from the bottom of the S, and then it just shoots straight up, and then it kind of curves off to the top and where you get to a mature market. Solar has really just now begun the explosive vertical growth coming up from the bottom of the S curve. And that has been driven by a lot of different things. Some of it is policy oriented, of course, having incentives and priority dispatch on the grid for renewables, that kind of thing. But also just the economics have now started to really turn in favor of solar. If you're a homeowner and you buy a system cash, a solar system for cash, and put that on your house, it's actually a very, very good investment over time. If you're working with a third-party financing company or one of these other type of arrangements where instead of buying the system cash, you're doing it through a lease arrangement or something like that, it's actually going to reduce your power bill right from the get-go, and you're not going to have any cash out of pocket at all. So it's making now very good economic sense for people who want to for residential users who want to install solar. On the commercial side, it's an even better investment because of the amount of power that commercial facilities typically use. So there's a very aggressive growth in the commercial market. And then on the utility side, the utility scale market where you're deploying megawatts at a time, again, that's being partially driven by policy, by renewable portfolio standards in different states where they're saying that they want to have X percent of renewable power on the grid by 2020 or 2030. California has, I think, the most aggressive RPS in the nation as far as that goes. And so we're now building out very large solar farms, particularly in the southern part of the state and in the southwest.
Right, and a lot of this is happening in the desert.
That's right.
Because that's very controversial. We've done a story about that. Or a show about that. When we think about solar, what should we envision? Because you kind of brought together all the different elements.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's really happening here is that as the cost of fossil fuels continues to go up, I mean, we've had sort of a temporary decline in shale gas prices and gas prices in the U.S., which has caused gas to displace a lot of coal power. But as we go through the coming decades, the cost of gas is going to go back up. The cost of coal will continue to go up. The cost of coal power is going to continue to be influenced by things like the new carbon emission standards, which will also increase the price of coal power. And nuclear power has now become kind of economically at a disadvantage to renewable power. It's actually becoming far too expensive to keep our very old nuclear plants operating. So in this year, we've had five nuclear plants scheduled for closure, and we'll probably see more in the coming decades. And so what's going to fill the gap is renewable power. And again, it's now becoming cheaper to do renewable power, both at a commercial scale, at a utility scale, and for residential users, than to stay with the status quo. So we're really seeing the beginning of a very big, long transformation to renewable power from conventional power.
And how are the oil and gas and the utility companies responding to all of this?
Well, you know, it's not as cut and dried as you might think. Gas companies actually stand to benefit from the explosion of renewable power on the grid because, as we all know, wind and solar power are not dispatchable. You know, you can't just call up wind or solar power when you want it. You have to use it when it's there. So when it's not available, you want to turn to a kind of power that you can just flip a switch and turn it on. And that's gas. It's not coal and it's not nuclear. It takes days, even as much as a week, to start up or shut down a nuclear plant or a coal-fired plant. So for gas producers, they're actually a natural complement to solar power. Oil is not really used in grid power in the United States anymore. We've pretty much phased that out over the last few decades. So gas companies actually stand to benefit from this substantially. Plus, you also have natural gas-powered fuel cells that are now becoming a big part of distributed grid power, what they call microgrids, which are actually very advantageous to utility operators who have a hard time supporting grid power at the extremity of the grid, where it's hard to maintain voltage and frequency and things like that. They can install these fuel cells, which run on natural gas, to help support the grid at those extremities, and we've just seen a big deal, in fact, cut between NRG energy and fuel cell energy to do just that. And so gas and renewables are going to be a nice pair.
That is Chris Nelder. He's an energy analyst who's written about these issues for more than a decade. He's the author of Profit from the Peak and Investing in Renewable Energy. And later today, he'll be speaking at the Verge Conference in San Francisco, which focuses on advancements in energy, buildings, and transportation. Tim Sears is co-founder of Grid Alternatives, a nonprofit solar installation company that focuses on helping low-income families install solar panels. And we'd love to hear from you if you have considered getting solar. How are you making your decision? What are your thoughts about the price coming down? It's dropped 70% since 2008. If you have solar, how did you go about it and what changes have you seen, especially in your utility bill? And then if you have any overall questions, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you. You always do shows that are exactly what I'm researching at the moment.
Oh, good.
I've been looking into this extensively, and my question for your panelists would be, I'm a very low-end user. I'm not a big user. In fact, I called the executive director of the Utility Reform Network in turn, because I'm a member there, and asked him for some suggestions, because they had an article in their newsletter that said if your electricity bill is not at a threshold of $75 a month, it isn't worth it for you to do. And I said, you know, my electric bill is only about $20 a month. And the executive director of TURN, who's very in favor of solar, just said, you know, for you, you should just continue to be a low user like you are and basically forget solar. It's not for you because you're not living in the Central Valley and using air conditioning all the time and you don't have a huge pool that's being heated. And I'm really a low-end user, and when I've called the different solar companies and given them all my facts and figures, they haven't raised. So I'm wondering, if I'm a real low-end user, is there any way? I mean, I want to do this.
Well, let's get a response from Tim. What would you say?
Well, first of all, congratulations on being so efficient.
Yeah, exactly.
No doubt.
You rarely hear that, right?
Yeah. Good problem to have, is your bill's too low. Well, I think one interesting opportunity is the increase in electric cars. So that could be something to look at. Obviously, that would increase your electric use and actually is a good complement with solar because you can produce your electricity during the day when it's more valuable to the utilities and then charge your car at night when the electricity is less expensive.
But those are still really expensive.
They are. The costs are coming down as well.
But so what would you say to Ruth Ann? I mean, you install solar panels for low-income people, which she, I mean, obviously you'd have to get her numbers, but since she's a low user. Would it work for her?
You know, the economics do depend on kind of your usage. In California, we have a tiered rate schedule, so the more electricity you use, the more you spend on it. So certainly solar can still work, just the savings are going to be lower and the economics may not work out as well.
What would you say, Chris, to someone who doesn't use much energy but wants solar?
You know, I used to install and sell systems in Marin County 2003 to 2005, and I encountered this situation quite a few times. So I'd like to second what Tim said. First of all, congratulations to the caller. That's absolutely fantastic that you're only spending $20 a month on grid power. If you really want to do solar and you don't mind, you know, that it's not going to be a terrific investment or that it's, I should say, that it's going to take a long time for you to recover that investment, then go ahead and do it. I mean, why not? And Tim made a great point that if you are interested at all in having an electric car, that would really increase your usage and make your solar system more valuable, and it would be certainly a lot cheaper than driving a gas-powered car.
How much are electric cars these days?
They're really sort of all over the map, you know, depending on if you want to buy a Nissan Leaf or a Tesla Roadster.
Well, let's say the cheapest one. It's like 60 or 70 grand, right?
No. Less than that. I think maybe 30.
Yeah, oh. I was going to say 30, 30, yeah. 35. You know, it's going to be kind of a low end.
Still not so cheap, but yeah, okay. Yeah.
There's leased products available. I drive a Ford, a Chevy Volt and love it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Ruthann. And maybe we can get some resources for people who don't use much energy and put it on our website after the show. We have a couple questions from listeners who couldn't stay on the line. What about homes that don't get good access to sun?
That is another tricky one that could be addressed by this new bill that just passed, the concept of community solar, shared solar, where it's unclear exactly how it's going to work in California here, but the concept is basically you kind of buy a share of a solar system that's not located at your house, and then you get credit on your bill, so you can take advantage of solar even if you have a big tree shading your roof.
And where do you find information for that?
Well, there are actually a number of what they call now community solar systems that you can buy into. You know, another interesting way to get into this is Oakland-based Mosaic, which is allowing regular people to buy shares in various solar systems. You can invest in Mosaic for as little as $25, and they offer, you know, a very reasonable return. I think it's usually on the order of 4 to 6%. And so even if you can't put solar on your own house, you can still invest in solar on some other building in the Bay Area.
And then speaking of buildings, another question, are unused buildings good places for panels? And are we seeing an increase in California?
Unused buildings? Well, if you're going to install a solar system on a building, you kind of have to be actually there and using it. The way that it's set up in California, you're going to need to strike what's called a net metering and an interconnection agreement with the utility, with PG&E up in this territory. And so it's hard to do that if you're not actually in the building.
What about buildings that just would be great for solar?
As far as I know, there are no arrangements to take unused or dormant real estate and just use it for solar power. Getting through the whole gauntlet of interconnection is going to be difficult.
All right. Well, thank you for those questions. Let's go next to Denny in Richmond. Hi, Denny.
How are you doing?
Hi.
Good. I have a question for your guests, and that's related to natural gas and the trumpeting a lot by folks that natural gas is the bridge to the future. I work for an organization called Global Community Monitor that's now helping people in five states track the toxic air contamination and exposure they're getting from fracking. And we don't believe that natural gas has any piece of this transition from fossil fuels because, of course, it's a fossil fuel. But I'd be curious to hear what your guests think about that. We think it's a really bad idea. to promote gas as a bridge to the future, because it's going to saddle us with fossil fuels for a long time.
You know, I have a lot of sympathy for your point. I've often said that natural gas is only a bridge to the future if you actually build something else on the other side of the bridge. Otherwise, it's just a bridge to a continued use of fossil fuels. I have done a lot of work on natural gas, particularly shale gas, written a lot of articles about it over the last couple of years. It's pretty clear to me that gas is an important and necessary part of being, you know, of kind of the grid of the future, of how we're going to offset the downtimes for solar and wind, as I mentioned earlier. Fracking is a very fraught subject. There are some places where contamination has occurred. There's also a lot of misinformation about where and when that has happened. It's really unfortunate that it's become just such an incredibly polarized debate. Now, there are tens of thousands of fracked shale gas wells in the United States that have not produced any contamination. There have been some bad actors. There have been some errors where it has produced contamination. So it's not really an either or. I think we need to proceed with shale gas, and we need to do it carefully and safely. But I also believe that there's been an awful lot of excessive optimism promoted by shale gas companies, and that the future of shale gas is not nearly as bright as they claim it is. And that's just simply because the resources are not as abundant and available as they've told us they will be.
Well, we've done a lot of shows about this. Go ahead, Denny.
About water contamination. Every single fracked well, compressor, dehydrator, all the way to the gas plant, leaks toxic emissions into the air and poisons people. And you're ignoring that when you're just focusing on water.
I think you're talking about fugitive emissions. Fugitive emissions are a problem. We've had a number of conflicting studies done over the last 2 years or so about just exactly what the extent of fugitive emissions are. I think that it's an important issue, and it's one that we need to watch. On the other hand, that's not new. It's not new to fracking. It's been an issue for a long time. I think it's something that the industry is really focusing on, and I think we will see some improvement in it. If what you're suggesting is that we should stop producing shale gas altogether because of the fugitive emissions issue, then I would just simply have to disagree. I don't think that's an option.
Well, I mean, have you seen Gasland?
Yes.
What did you think of it?
I thought it presented some compelling evidence. I also thought it was extremely shrill and really sort of one-sided.
Well, because we've done a lot of shows about water contamination and just the effect that fracking has on health. Mm-hmm. So many sick people. In fact, people went to the White House a couple of weeks ago to have a rally about their health, and then major water contamination, and then the food supplies being affected by it also.
That's right.
And, you know, there a number of studies have come out about this.
Yes, indeed.
We're going to go to a quick break. Today we are talking about the rise in solar power. The price of solar has dropped 70% since 2008. And so we're talking about why the price has gone down and what does this mean for the future of renewable energy. We'll be back after this.
Local Public Radio. If you'd like to join today's conversation, here's the number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or you can send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Tell us why. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Frances Moore LePay and Anna LePay about the connection between food, climate, and consumption. 42 years after the publication of Frances Moore LePay's best-selling book, Diet for a Small Planet, what have we learned about our food system? What has gotten worse and what has improved? And how can we move from conscious consumer consumption to collective action? That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll be joined by four of the Brower Youth Award winners. These are young environmentalists doing really incredible work across the country. And on Tuesday night, the Brower Youth Awards are taking place in San Francisco. It's a free event. It's a great, inspiring event. And you can find information about that at the Earth Island Institute's website. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about solar power. It's traditionally been dismissed as an ethical luxury, but since 2008, the price of solar has dropped 70%. And rooftop solar is taking off across the country. Here in California, the solar industry is now worth more than $2 billion. So if you have any questions about solar, we'd love to hear from you. If you've installed solar panels, what changes have you seen? If you work in the industry, we'd love to hear from you. And what do you think this means for the future of alternative energy? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Rose. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
And your guest. Hey, I think the real crux of the problem here is this doesn't fit the business model of the utility companies. PG&E and Southern Edison become obsolete if we try to institute what Germany has done, put in a feed-in tariff or do this net metering and start paying people for producing electricity. They don't want it because it makes them obsolete and it's going to hurt their profits big time. We need a paradigm shift in thinking in this country, and we got to face off with PG&E and Southern Edison and these other utility companies and say, this is not the way it's going to be, fellas. Things have got to change. And it might also come about Solar City. I think they have a different business model, too, where they actually help finance people to put the solar cells on the homes, and then they buy the electricity, and they become like electricity company or utility themselves, which is kind of unique. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Andy. So, Tim, do you think that eventually the solar or the utility companies will be obsolete?
Well, I think for the foreseeable future, there's still going to be an important role for the utilities. Until we have a storage solution, you really need the grid there to be able to feed power back on and do what we call net metering. And I think various utilities throughout the country are taking more or less of a progressive role in solar, but there's certainly room for them to play a positive role in it. And California has a policy where they've tried to decouple the profit motive of the utilities from how much energy they actually produce. And that has been really successful in helping incentivize the utilities to encourage conservation as well as uptake of renewable energy.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, the caller is absolutely right. There is a big transformation underway. I've written a lot of articles about that this year. If folks want to go to my blog, getreallist.com, they'll see the articles I've written for Smart Planet, Green Tech Media, The Atlantic, and so on about this very subject. The issue really is, yes, solar power does present a economic challenge to the utilities, and the utilities are very concerned about it. A big report this year by the Edison Electric Institute, which is a coalition of investor-owned utilities, zeroed right in on that question and actually worried aloud about what they called the utility death spiral, where more solar customers coming onto the grid reduces the revenues available to the utilities to maintain the grid, but they still have to maintain it. And so the costs now have to be passed on to a smaller and smaller pool of non-solar users on the grid, which then continues to shift the economics in favor of those people going solar as well. And so it just kind of becomes a feedback loop. So the utilities are grappling with this question. There have been a number of closed-door and very high-profile open discussions about it. Jim Rogers, who's leaving as the CEO of Duke Energy, has been out talking about this very publicly. David Crane from NRG Energy has been talking about it very publicly.
Actually, David Crane called solar, quote, a mortal threat to the investor-owned utilities business.
That's right. That's right. And so one of the things that I, one of the ideas I've sort of wondered about in one of my pieces is whether or not investor-owned utilities can survive this transformation. It seems as though a number of them are probably at risk of being converted back to municipal utilities, where you kind of take the profit motivation out of it, out of the equation a little bit, and then you're actually more responsive to ratepayers in your utility area who really want to use solar.
And then here in California, under a recently passed bill, the CPUC could consider allowing the state's big investor-owned utilities to charge flat fees of up to $10 per month to every solar customer?
It's actually to every customer.
Every customer.
And there's that's five for low-income care customers. But
and why?
I think it's partly to address the issue of kind of fixed transmission costs. Even solar customers still use the grid to feed back their excess production during the day and take it back during the night. So it's been interesting to see the conversation change from, oh, solar's too expensive, it's, you know, just a drop in the bucket, to now, oh, there's so much solar going on, it's negatively impacting everyone else's.
So this would be $10 on top of your energy bill a month.
Yes.
So someone like Ruth Ann, who spends $20 a month, would have to pay $25?
Potentially, yes. And that's, you know, one of the big talking points has been kind of where that cost shift is going to happen. Is it just kind of the wealthier people who can afford the solar, and then that cost shift gets passed on to renters and low-income people, which is one of the reasons why Grid Alternatives feels it's important to make sure there's access to solar for all of our communities.
And when does the CPUC have to make this decision? Because it seems like people should speak out on this if they'd like.
I don't know the specific timeline. It was just passed as part of AB 327, which was just signed by the governor. And I don't know off the top of my head the timeline.
All right. Well, we should get that information. All right. Well, let's go to another caller who's got a question about PG&E. Let's hear from Steve in Oakland. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I recently got panels installed, but in my research, I was looking at a handful of community solar companies. There's a really interesting one in outside of London in Brixton. My understanding is, in trying to do that here in Oakland, that people have run into PG&E in some way, that there's a requirement that PG&E be part of the mix or something like that. I wonder if you could clarify.
So until recently, it hasn't been possible in California to do what's called share solar or community solar, where you have people buy shares of a larger solar system located centrally and then get credited on their bills for the production there. This bill that just passed is going to allow it, and actually it was piloted as part of the multifamily affordable solar housing or MASH program specifically for large multifamily residential buildings, where you could put it on the roof and then all the tenants could get credit for it. Again, this is a bill that was just signed by the governor, so I'm not sure exactly how it's going to be enacted, but it will be through the utilities where you sign up for this and then are able to get a credit on your bill, is how I understand it.
All right. Thank you for the call, Steve. Steve. We've got a number of emails, and I want to go through a few. Henry writes, I've contacted solar companies several times to get panels on my house in Berkeley, but they refused for two reasons. Same as your caller, Ruth Ann. The company refused because we don't use enough electricity. My daughter and son-in-law had the same experience. They said we'd have to cut down the trees around our house. This is not some suburban setting, just a basic house in Berkeley's flatlands, but we have a couple of trees in the yard. As it happens, our next-door neighbor has a big south-facing roof and no trees, so an obvious solution to both of the above problems would be for us and our neighbor to go in together, put panels on her roof, and then share the panels. But the company has adamantly refused to consider any such solution. They said the legal issues were way too complicated. Maybe the community solar legislation one of your guests mentioned would solve this, but somehow we need a simple neighborhood-based solution. What are your thoughts, Chris?
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think Tim is more of an expert on this than I am, but PG&E doesn't support that right now. The solar system is tied to a specific PG&E account, which is tied to the house, and there is a real nest of legal issues in there that needs to be overcome to allow what the caller wants.
No. I should just mention that Grid Alternatives, we do our work with volunteers. So if you're interested in participating in a solar installation and being part of solar but can't get it on your house, I encourage you to come out and volunteer with us. It's a lot of fun.
And that is Tim Sears. He's co-founder of Grid Alternatives, a nonprofit solar installation company that focuses on helping low-income families install solar. Chris Nelder is an energy analyst who's written about these issues for more than a decade. He's the author of Profit from the Peak and Investing in Renewable Energy. He'll be speaking at the Verge Conference later today in San Francisco, which focuses on advancements in energy, buildings, and transportation. A couple more emails. Robert in Oakland says, can you talk about reports of defective solar panels, especially from China? How widespread is this problem? Do you know, Chris?
I have seen those reports. I don't believe it is enormously widespread. It's kind of one of those things that's hard to quantify. There are a lot of different manufacturers. There are a lot of different modules. And no matter where your manufacturer is located, kind of every module is kind of its own being. Every single module out there, no matter who it's made by, has its own productivity. And every module sort of has to be tested to see what it can do. You could manufacture an entire batch of modules that will supposedly have a certain number of watts of output, and you find that some actually have less output, and so they get sold as a different rating. It's kind of a difficult thing to answer in the general case.
And Chan in Berkeley says, we live in a condo association that has PV on the roof. PV, photovoltaic.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And we love it. A local developer wants to get special exemptions to the current development plan for our neighborhood that would erect a huge building directly across the street from us in such a way that we would probably lose about a third of our electricity due to shading on the roof. Someone once mentioned something about a California law that protects solar access for installed solar systems. Is there really such a law? Please discuss the broader issues here regarding development and potential conflicts over development. Who'd like to take that?
Well, there is such a law, and I know I've researched it before, and I don't remember off the top of my head the name of the law. But if you Google solar access laws, you can find it, and there is a legal protection for the investment that you've made in the solar.
I don't know what the development side of this question is, but I do know from my days in the solar business that if, for example, you put in a solar system and your neighbor has trees that grow up so that it starts to shade your system, your neighbor is required to keep those trees trimmed back. So there is such a law.
And Aaron writes, regarding Ruth Ann, who only pays $20 a month in electricity charges, under the new community solar law, wouldn't she benefit from being the host roof for a solar array that provides electricity for others, maybe even her neighbors?
Yeah, again, the details of that will have to be worked out. My guess is that typically those are going to be larger systems, so you would need a larger roof than a typical residential house.
And if we had a good feed-in tariff, wouldn't rooftop solar be an income source for her?
Absolutely. I'm a huge proponent of feed-in tariffs. It's something I've looked at closely. I've even offered a proposal for how the U.S. might institute a national feed-in tariff. Unfortunately, unlike European countries where they have feed-in tariffs, the U.S. is just an enormous mess of regulation that it would take a serious a lot of serious federal leadership from FERC and probably from the presidency to put in a national feed-in tariff. But if there were such a thing nationally, absolutely. Now, it should be said that California does have a feed-in tariff, but it's structured and priced in such a way that it probably would not benefit Ruth Ann.
And we have an email from a listener who says the bottom-end Nissan Leaf electric car is $21,300.
Oh, well, thank you, caller.
So, thank you. when you look at what Europe has done compared to the United States, what are the major changes? And is it because the industry has so much power in the United States?
I'm not
talking about the solar industry. I'm talking about the oil and gas and the utility industry.
Certainly the power of the incumbents is limiting progress in the United States. But it's also true that the U.S. simply grew up in such a way that, you know, the whole evolution of our grid and our utility architecture kind of grew up in an ad hoc fashion. You know, we put in a new city or a new town or a new subdivision, and we just sort of built utility power for that. And it was never designed top down. And then over time, various regulatory structures have grown up. So now you have nationally this whole very, very complicated system where at the top you have FERC regulating the interstate flow of wholesale electricity, and then you've got regional transmission organizations, independent system operator organizations, and then you've got all the different utilities, and they cover different areas. And because the United States is fundamentally a republic, we have designed most of these regulations at a state level rather than at a federal level. So there are literally hundreds, probably thousands of different regulatory structures that would have to be harmonized to allow us to do what Europe is able to do. I should point out a really interesting case in the United States is Texas. There are three main grids in the United States. There's the East Coast interconnection, the West Coast interconnection, and Texas. Texas is the only state, well, other than Alaska and Hawaii, obviously, that has its own grid. It's the only state in the lower 48 that has its own grid. And they have one system operator, ERCOT. Because of that, ERCOT has been able to plan to accommodate a lot of wind power and a lot of solar power, and they've been able to support it and get it onto the grid and expand it much more rapidly than a lot of other states have been able to do, and that's because they have one unified grid with one unified operator. You know, in Germany, you basically have one harmonized set of grid rules and one harmonized market.
And so, are Texans embracing wind and solar?
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the most progressive utilities in the nation is a municipal utility called CPS Energy, based out of San Antonio. I think they've offered some really great leadership to the entire utility industry in terms of you know, how to accommodate renewables onto the grid, how to work with customers in their territory to support that without being punitive, you know, to solar operators and generators and so on. There's a lot of interesting stuff happening in Texas, and you know, they're the wind power champion of the U.S.
Well, thanks again for the emails. And we've got a number of calls. Let's try to get in as many as we can before we end. Let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. Very interested in your program. I heard answers to several of my questions in the last few minutes, but I have some very quick comments to make. I am interested in what can we do to adopt or to work toward getting some of these German concepts in place here in California. I know it's a challenge from a regulatory standpoint, but we need workable tasks that those of us who have solar on our roofs can adopt and push to move this, because otherwise we're just at the mercy of the Koch brothers and people like that who don't want this to go forward. So some guidance on that would be appreciated.
Thank you. Then, and let's take that question first. And I just read from this website, Clean Technica, renewable solar and wind energy produced in Germany as much as 60% of all of their electricity on October 3rd. They just keep beating their own records.
On October 3rd, yeah. And, you know, that was a particularly windy and sunny day. I think the record for Germany is 34% on a daily basis. That 60% was kind of, I think, a two-hour basis. On a daily basis, I think they've done about 34% from wind and solar as their record. And that was actually almost all wind. That was New Year's Eve last year.
What is our record?
California or the U.S.?
The U.S.,
I don't know, but I would guess it's pretty low.
I don't know.
Like
it's
single digit?
Single digits, yeah. For sure. Yeah, for sure.
60%, that's huge.
On a momentary basis, yeah. On an annual basis, Germany is now producing about 25% of its total power demand from wind and solar. So they are by far the solar leader. In fact, there's about 100 gigawatts of solar power installed in the world, and Germany has about 35 gigawatts of that, so...
And their solar resource, if you look at a map, is pretty similar to the state of Alaska. So it's not because they have more sun than the rest of the world.
No, that's right. In fact, the only part of the U.S., of the lower 48, that has less sun than Germany is Western Washington, basically Seattle.
And then, so it's important to also say that Germany is about the size of Montana.
Right.
And 81 million people, just for a little perspective.
That's right. No, that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. But technically, I see absolutely no reason why the United States could not follow the German model in terms of deployment. I mean, one of the biggest things we need to do in the U.S. is get down the soft costs of installation. It costs half as much to install a solar system in Germany as it does in the U.S. And most of that is not because of the cost of the hardware. It costs one-tenth as much to acquire a customer in Germany as it does in the U.S. And a lot of that's because they have the feed-in tariff, but also they've got a unified system, and so marketing is easier. Costs for permitting, inspection, and interconnection in Germany are about one-tenth of the U.S. because they have a harmonized system for doing that. In the U.S., and particularly in California, there's just an enormously complex, oftentimes unnecessary, burdensome, redundant set of requirements and hoops you have to jump through just to pull a permit to install a solar system here in California. So the best thing, just to address what the caller was asking about, that we could do in California is to standardize building and planning requirements for PV systems. I mean, at least we could do that for California. And then for the municipal leaders of each town and county in California to try to clear away the hurdles to pulling a permit, make it cheap and make it easy. I mean, one of the most interesting examples, I think, in California is Lancaster, where Mayor Rex Paris directed city staff to just find reasons to say yes rather than reasons to say no for solar permits. And so they refined their building and planning requirements. They made it a lot easier to pull a permit. And now if you're a contractor and you want to install solar in Lancaster, you can just go in over the counter, no appointment, pull a permit in 15 minutes, and it's $61. That's the way it should be.
Oh, we have an email from Faye in San Francisco who says, does San Francisco still rebate homeowners who go solar? That comes from the PUC, fees from the water I pay for. As a resident living in an apartment, why should I subsidize homeowners, many of whom live in multi-million-dollar homes? Why not pay for your own home improvements? With the price drop in solar, there is even less reason we should subsidize homeowners. The more fair approach would be to spend the money to install solar on city buildings and public infrastructure. Those are public, and they would benefit all of us.
So,
Tim.
She's speaking about the Go Solar San Francisco rebate program, and it is still available and does provide extra incentive for anyone in San Francisco that wants to go solar. There are increased levels for low-income homeowners and there's also a job training component of that where you get additional dollars if you use someone who agrees to follow some workforce development
rules. So there are things that are built into that program to try to address the equity and fairness issues.
All right. Thank you for the email, Faye. We have a few callers who want to know the best way about doing this. What is the cheapest way to get solar? It still seems expensive. What would you say, Chris?
Well, the cheapest way is to go through one of the third-party financing companies like SolarCity, Sungevity, and there's actually quite a few others. These companies, if you have an unobstructed roof or a yard location, and your bill is sufficiently high to really make the investment worthwhile, they will come in, install solar on your property. You will not pay anything out of pocket. You will strike a leasing and a power purchase agreement with them, and they will so you'll actually be paying off the solar system as if you were just paying your regular power bill. Only they'll usually bring down your power bill very slightly, like maybe $5 a month cheaper than what you would be paying otherwise. That's by far the easiest way to do it if you don't have the money to just buy the system outright for cash. If you do have the money to buy the system outright for cash, then your return on investment is going to be better, obviously.
All right. And then what are your predictions? What's going to happen in the next couple of years?
Define the next couple of years, because I can give you predictions for 5 years or 50.
Let's say 5 or 10.
10 years? You know, one of the really interesting things this year has been the number of major investment bank analysts from, like, Deutsche Bank, Citibank, and so on, who have come out with reports projecting that wind and solar power are going to be the cheapest way to generate power in 75% of the world by 2020. So by the end of this decade, the economics are going to tilt in favor of renewable power for certainly for the U.S. and Europe and also in places where grid access still isn't even available, like parts of India. So I think that's the next big transformation over the next decade, is we're going to see renewables simply undercutting fossil fuels on the grid by price alone.
Chris Nelder is an energy analyst. He'll be speaking later today at the Verge Conference in San Francisco, focusing on technology advancements in energy. Tim Sears is co-founder of Alternatives, a nonprofit solar installation company that focuses on helping low-income families get solar. Thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How should we move from conscious customer consumption to collective action? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Francis Moore LePay and Anna LePay about the connection between food, climate, and consumption. 42 years after the publication of Francis Moore LePay's best-selling book, Diet for a Small Planet, what have we learned about our food system? What's gotten worse and what's improved? What will it take to make real changes to the food system? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.